Professor Professor Lentz. Our next speaker is Ralph Rossum. Professor Rossum is a Phi Beta Kappa. He's held numerous administrative positions at several colleges and universities around the country. He's the author of, by my count, 9 books on criminal justice, the American founding, constitutional law, and the like. He has studied at the University of Chicago and Concordia College. He holds the Salvatore Professorship in American Constitutionalism and is the director of the Rose Institute of State and Local Government at Claremont McKenna College. Ralph Ross.
Well, thank you and good morning. I should say at the outset that I have a paper far too long to deliver this morning, but it is available on the website of the Philadelphia Society. Bill Campbell put it on last week. And we are apparently having gloomy themes here of the future of America. My paper is entitled The 17th Amendment and the Death of Federalism. Madison refers to a dual security in our constitutional system, separation of powers and federalism. And of course, neither federalism nor separation of powers is ever described or articulated in the Constitution. We know we have these arrangements by looking at specifics and then inferring a concept or an understanding of separation of powers and federalism from them. And I want to begin with that kind of understanding, that federalism is not written in the document. It exists structurally. And if you alter the structure of something that exists only structurally, you alter it. And it's no longer what it was before. And I use this premise to launch into a recent book, and partly the argument today comes from this book, a book that is a wholesale attack on the Supreme Court's activist decisions in the realm of federalism, especially the state sovereign immunity cases, but also Lopez against the United States, its understanding of the Commerce Clause, the commandeering cases in Prince and New York against the United States, the city of Bernie against Flores, and the court's very constricted understanding of Congress's power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. And I make the argument that we've had since 1992 12 major decisions striking down congressional enactments by the Supreme Court, almost in every instance where you'll find the argument made that this is being done to secure, to protect the original federal design. And my argument is that design no longer exists because of the 17th Amendment. My argument in a nutshell, and I should say at the outset as well, I find it really ironic that the court now is the great defender of federalism against what Congress wants to do, but not along the way ever willing to reconsider the incorporation doctrine. If the court really wanted to assist a revitalization of federalism, it would undo the decisions incorporating all the various Bill of Rights provisions to apply to the states. But instead, the court is picking at what Congress has done and saying Congress lacks the power to allow states to be sued in federal court for patent violations by state officers. It seems unseemly for the court to worry about the speck in the Congress's eye when it seems unaware of the log in its own, to make a reference. Well, anyway, the argument of the book basically goes as follows, that the framers did not expect that federalism would be protected by an activist court, but rather by constitutional structure, in particular the mode of electing the Senate. Senators were elected by state legislatures. They went there as ambassadors from their states. They knew that when they would come back and stand for re-election, they would appear before legislative committees of their two legislative chambers in the state, and would have to give an account as to why they had voted for measures that had transferred the inviolable and residuary sovereignty, to use that phrase from Federalist 39, the inviolable and residuary sovereignty of the states to the federal government. There might be occasions on which that could be justified, but there might be on other occasions where it couldn't be justified, and where interested men serving in the state legislature wanting that job of the senator might see to it that that senator was booted, or surely given instructions, literally, as to how to act and vote in the future. That was widely understood at the time of the founding. Let me just read a passage from Alexander Hamilton in the New York Ratifying Convention. "When you take a view of all the circumstances which I have recited, you will see that the senators will constantly look up to the state governments with an eye of dependence and affection. If they are ambitious to continue in office, they will seek to make every prudent arrangement for this purpose. And whatever may be their private sentiments or politics, they will be convinced that the surest means of obtaining re-election will be a uniform attachment to the interest of their several states." A great statement after the Constitution is in place. Roger Sherman, writing to John Adams in July of 1789, "The senators, being eligible by the legislatures of the several states and dependent on them for re-election, will be vigilant in supporting their rights against infringement by the legislative and executive of the United States." This notion of vigilance, that vigilant senators will not vote for matters that transfer power from the states to the federal government unless there's a really compelling reason that they can sell to the state legislatures back home, that was the structural means by which federalism was to be protected. Yet the political and social forces that in the late 19th century, culminating in 1913, that lead to the drafting and ratification of the 17th Amendment change all that. The 17th Amendment, providing for direct election of senators, totally pulls the rug out from senators representing the interest of states as states. Suddenly they have a constituency that's not fundamentally different from members of the House of Representatives. And as a consequence, the original means of protecting federalism, altered by the 17th Amendment, alters federalism. And for the court today to try to protect the original federal design after the 17th Amendment is as inappropriate as if the court today were attempt to enforce the Constitution's original accommodations of slavery after the post-Civil War amendments. Now, the 17th Amendment was approved by the public, committed to making the Constitution more democratic. Progressives argued forcefully, persistently, and ultimately successfully that the democratic principle required that the Senate be elected by the people rather than indirectly by state legislatures. The consequences of the ratification of the 17th Amendment on federalism, however, went completely unexplored. I've gone through the records of about a 40-year period in the Congress where various proposals were introduced. Six times the House adopts measures, secures the two-thirds vote necessary to adopt a constitutional amendment. Five of those six times the Senate refuses, and finally in 1911 concurs. I've gone through all of those debates, and I can find three members ever, one in the House, Franklin Bartlett, a Democrat from New York, and two in the Senate, George Hoar from Massachusetts and Elihu Root from New York, who ever make an argument against direct election of the Senate on the ground that it was going to destroy the way the interests of states as states was secured. The public wanted democracy and inattentively changed the structure of the Constitution so as to jeopardize and, I would say, ultimately render kill federalism. People, in their desire to make the Constitution more democratic, abandoned what the framers thought was the critical structural mechanism for protecting the federal-state balance in the interest of states as states. It's following the 17th Amendment in 1913, and this can be dismissed what I'm about to say is somewhat of a reductionist argument. How do you establish cause and effect? But it's in the post-17th Amendment era that the Supreme Court starts for the first time actively striking down federal laws as violating the federal design. It's as if the court needs to step in and fill the gap created by the 17th Amendment. And there are some scholars who say that's the role that the court should play. They should preserve that original design. If indirect election of senators won't do it, then judicial activism must. But my argument goes to the contrary, fidelity to the text of the Constitution and understanding it as a structural document requires that we understand that federalism is rendered effectively a nullity in our constitutional system. That the framers surely never anticipated that the job of the court would be to prevent Congress from passing laws that trench on state sovereignty or state residuary sovereignty. That questions of federalism are questions of prudential line drawing. Federalist 78 talks about the Supreme Court having the power of judicial review and mentions as an example that you need a court that can strike down laws if you have a limited constitution. And that is, Hamilton says a limited constitution is one in which there are specific exceptions to powers contained. And he gives two examples, bills of attainder and ex post facto laws. And he said a court is absolutely essential to protect those specific exceptions by striking down things that are contrary to the manifest tenor of the Constitution. I think we've all heard that phrase, the manifest tenor. Passing an ex post facto law violates, it's contrary to the manifest tenor. There are clear words. What about federalism? When does Congress's power under the Commerce Clause go too far? There isn't a specificity in the document as there is with regard to bill of attainder, ex post facto laws. There's a question of prudential judgment. How much is too much? And the framers thought that senators, vigilant about protecting their jobs, would be the ones to decide how far is too far. And never expected that the courts would enter that fray. In part, understanding, as Brutus pointed out, that a rising tide lifts all boats, that as the federal government's power grew, so would the power of federal judges. And they didn't understand that it was in the best interest even of federalism that courts attempt to step in and protect it. Remember the great statement by Madison in Federalist 46. If in the future the people become more partial to the federal than to the state governments, in that case the people ought surely not to be precluded from giving most of their confidence where they may discover it to be most due. Madison says that he's confident that such a change would only result from such a manifest and irresistible proof of a better administration by the federal government as will overcome all the people's antecedent propensities. Yet nonetheless, if that proof were there, he didn't want the court stepping in the way and saying that the federal government, including senators elected by states, couldn't enhance the power of the federal government at the expense of the states. Well, the court has stepped in, I think, contrary to the original design, to the original understanding of the role of the court, and has attempted to protect federalism. And there gets to be a real irony in this, in that an amendment, the 17th Amendment, that was adopted in the hope of making the Constitution more democratic, is now met by a Supreme Court perfectly happy and willing to strike down actions passed by that now Democratic Senate in the name of federalism. What my argument at bottom is that that federalism is a principle that can secure liberty is effectively dead and gone. The political and social forces that made people want senators democratic and not federal has taken its toll. And that when the Supreme Court spends all of its time trying to resuscitate federalism by taking these acts, all it's doing is attempting to breathe life into a corpse. Abraham Lincoln, in his Lyceum address, worried that the walls of our Constitution would be rendered, would be lowered, would be destroyed, would be leveled, not by invading foemen, but by the silent artillery of time. And my argument is that over time, the public forgot the reason for why the Senate was to be indirectly elected by state legislatures, forgot about how it was the means of securing the interests of states as states, and that the invading foemen have not hurt us, but the silent artillery of time led even the Congress and the Senate, as they were considering ratification of the adoption of the 17th Amendment, to forget those reasons, that we've leveled the walls of federalism by the passage of the 17th Amendment, and the Supreme Court should allow that remain, should allow for federalism to rest in peace, the ultimate victim of the silent artillery of time. Thank you.